In other words, our obligation to seek truth is part of our general obligation to do what pays. In a chapter on pragmatism and religion, he reaps the harvest. We cannot reject any hypothesis if consequences useful to life flow from it. If the hypothesis of God works satisfactorily in the widest sense of the word, it is true. We may well believe, on the proofs that religious experience affords, that higher powers exist and are at work to save the world on ideal lines similar to our own. I find great intellectual difficulties in this doctrine. It assumes that a belief is true when its effects are good, if this definition is to be useful, and if not, it is condemned by the pragmatist's test. We must know A, what is good, B, what are the effects of this or that belief, and we must know these things before we can know anything is true, since it is only after we have decided that the effects of a belief are good that we have a right to call it true. The result is an incredible complication. Suppose you want to know whether Columbus crossed the Atlantic in 1492. You must not, as other people do, look it up in a book. You must first inquire what are the effects of this belief and how they differ from the effects of believing that he sailed in 1491 or 1493. This is difficult enough, but it is still more difficult to weigh the effects from an ethical point of view. You may say that obviously 1492 has the best effects, since it gives you higher grades in examinations. But your competitors, who would surpass you if you said 1491 or 1493, may consider your success instead of theirs ethically regrettable. Apart from examinations, I cannot think of any practical effects of the belief except in the case of a historian. But this is not the end of the trouble. You must hold that your estimate of the consequences of a belief, both ethical and factual, is true. For if it is false, your argument for the truth of your belief is mistaken. But to say that your belief as to consequences true is, according to James, to say that it has good consequences, and this in turn is only true if it has good consequences, and so on ad infinitum. Obviously this won't do. There is another difficulty. Suppose I say there was such a person as Columbus. Everyone will agree that what I say is true. But why is it true? Because of a certain man of flesh and blood who lived 450 years ago? In short, because of the causes of my belief, not because of its effects. With James's definition, it might happen that A exists is true, although in fact A does not exist. I have always found that the hypothesis of Santa Claus works satisfactorily in the widest sense of the word. Therefore, Santa Claus exists is true, although Santa Claus does not exist. James says, I repeat, if the hypothesis of God works satisfactorily in the widest sense of the word, it is true. This simply omits as unimportant the question whether God really is in his heaven. If he is a useful hypothesis, that is enough. God, the architect of the cosmos, is forgotten. All that is remembered is belief in God and its effects upon the creatures inhabiting our petty planet. No wonder the Pope condemned the pragmatic defense of religion. We come here to a fundamental difference between James's religious outlook and that of religious people in the past. James is interested in religion as a human phenomenon, but shows little interest in the objects which religion contemplates. He wants people to be happy, and if belief in God makes them happy, let them believe in him. This, so far, is only benevolence, not philosophy. It becomes philosophy when it is said that if the belief makes them happy, it is true. To the man who desires an object of worship, this is unsatisfactory. He is not concerned to say, if I believed in God, I should be happy. He is concerned to say, I believe in God, and therefore I am happy. And when he believes in God, he believes in him as he believes in the existence of Roosevelt or Churchill or Hitler. God, for him, is an actual being, not merely a human idea which has good effects. It is this genuine belief that has the good effects, not James's emasculate substitute. It is obvious that if I say Hitler exists, I do not mean the effects of believing that Hitler exists are good, and to the genuine believer, the same is true of God. James's doctrine is an attempt to build a superstructure of belief upon a foundation of skepticism, and like all such attempts, it is dependent on fallacies. In his case, the fallacies spring from an attempt to ignore all extra-human facts. Berkeleyan idealism combined with skepticism causes him to substitute belief in God for God, and to pretend that this will do just as well. But this is only a form of the subjectivistic madness which is characteristic of most modern philosophy. Chapter 30. John Dewey. John Dewey, who was born in 1859, is generally admitted to be the leading living philosopher of America. In this estimate, I entirely concur. He has had a profound influence, not only among philosophers, but on students of education, aesthetics, and political theory. He is a man of the highest character, liberal in outlook, generous and kind in personal relations, indefatigable in work. With most of his opinions, I am in almost complete agreement. Owing to my respect and admiration for him, as well as to personal experience of his kindness, I should wish to agree completely. But to my regret, I am compelled to dissent from his most distinctive philosophical doctrine, namely, the substitution of inquiry for truth as the fundamental concept of logic and theory of knowledge. Like William James, Dewey is a New Englander and carries on the tradition of New England liberalism, which has been abandoned by some of the descendants of the great New Englanders of 100 years ago. He has never been what might be called a mere philosopher. Education, especially, has been in the forefront of his interests, and his influence on American education has been profound. I, in my lesser way, have tried to have an influence on education very similar to his. Perhaps he, like me, has not always been satisfied with the practice of those who professed to follow his teaching, but any new doctrine in practice is bound to be subject to some extravagance and excess. This, however, does not matter so much as might be thought, because the faults of what is new are so much more easily seen than those of what is traditional. When Dewey became professor of philosophy at Chicago in 1894, pedagogy was included among his subjects. He founded a progressive school and wrote much about education. What he wrote at this time was summed up in his book, The School and Society, 1899, which is considered the most influential of all his writings. He has continued to write on education throughout his life, almost as much as on philosophy. Other social and political questions have also had a large share of his thought. Like myself, he was much influenced by visits to Russia and China, negatively in the first case, positively in the second. He was reluctantly a supporter of the First World War. He had an important part in the inquiry as to Trotsky's alleged guilt, and while he was convinced that the charges were unfounded, he did not think that the Soviet regime would have been satisfactory if Trotsky instead of Stalin had been Lenin's successor. He became persuaded that violent revolution, leading to dictatorship, is not the way to achieve a good society. Although very liberal in all economic questions, he has never been a Marxist. I heard him say once that, having emancipated himself with some difficulty from the traditional orthodox theology, he was not going to shackle himself with another. In all this, his point of view is almost identical with my own. From the strictly philosophic point of view, the chief importance of Dewey's work lies in his criticism of the traditional notion of truth, which is embodied in the theory that he calls instrumentalism. Truth, as conceived by most professional philosophers, is static and final, perfect and eternal. In religious terminology, it may be identified with God's thoughts, and with those thoughts which, as rational beings, we share with God. The perfect model of truth is the multiplication table, which is precise and certain and free from all temporal dross. Since Pythagoras, and still more since Plato, mathematics has been linked with theology and has profoundly influenced the theory of knowledge of most professional philosophers. Dewey's interests are biological rather than mathematical, and he conceives thought as an evolutionary process. The traditional view would, of course, admit that men gradually come to know more, but each piece of knowledge, when achieved, is regarded as something final. Hegel, it is true, does not regard human knowledge in this way. He conceives human knowledge as an organic whole, gradually growing in every part, and not perfect in any part until the whole is perfect. But although the Hegelian philosophy influenced Dewey in his youth, it still has its absolute, and its eternal world, which is more real than the temporal process. These can have no place in Dewey's thought, for which all reality is temporal, and process, though evolutionary, is not, as for Hegel, the unfolding of an eternal idea. So far, I am in agreement with Dewey. Nor is this the end of my agreement. Before embarking upon discussion of the points as to which I differ, I will say a few words as to my own view of truth. The first question is, what sort of thing is true or false? The simplest answer would be a sentence. Columbus crossed the ocean in 1492 is true. Columbus crossed the ocean in 1776 is false. This answer is correct but incomplete. Sentences are true or false, as the case may be, because they are significant, and their significance depends upon the language used. If you were translating an account of Columbus into Arabic, you would have to alter 1492 into the corresponding year of the Mohammedan era. Sentences in different languages may have the same significance, and it is the significance, not the words, that determines whether the sentence is true or false. When you assert a sentence, you express a belief, which may be equally well expressed in a different language. The belief, whatever it may be, is what is true or false or more or less true. Thus we are driven to the investigation of belief. Now, a belief, provided it is sufficiently simple, may exist without being expressed in words. It would be difficult, without using words, to believe that the ratio of the circumference of a circle to the diameter is approximately 3.14159, or that Caesar, when he decided to cross the Rubicon, sealed the fate of the Roman Republican Constitution. But in simple cases, unverbalized beliefs are common. Suppose, for instance, in a descending staircase, you make a mistake as to when you have got to the bottom. You take a step suitable for level ground and come down with a bump. The result is a violent shock of surprise. You would naturally say, "I thought I was at the bottom." But in fact, you were not thinking about the stairs, or you would not have made the mistake. Your muscles were adjusted in a way suitable to the bottom, when in fact, you were not yet there. It was your body, rather than your mind, that made the mistake. At least, that would be a natural way to express what happened. But in fact, the distinction between mind and body is a dubious one. It would be better to speak of an organism, leaving the division of its activities between the mind and the body undetermined. One can say, then, your organism was adjusted in a manner which would have been suitable if you had been at the bottom, but in fact was not suitable. This failure of adjustment constituted error, and one may say that you were entertaining a false belief. The test of error in the above illustration is surprise. I think this is true generally of beliefs that can be tested. A false belief is one which, in suitable circumstances, will cause the person entertaining it to experience surprise, while a true belief will not have this effect. But although surprise is a good criterion when it is applicable, it does not give the meaning of the words true and false, and is not always applicable. Suppose you are walking in a thunderstorm, and you say to yourself, "I am not at all likely to be struck by lightning." The next moment you are struck, but you experience no surprise because you are dead. If one day the sun explodes, as Sir James Jeans seems to expect, we shall all perish instantly and therefore not be surprised. But unless we expect the catastrophe, we shall all have been mistaken. Such illustrations suggest objectivity in truth and falsehood. What is true or false is a state of the organism, but it is true or false in general, in virtue of occurrences outside the organism. Sometimes experimental tests are possible to determine truth and falsehood, but sometimes they are not. When they are not, the alternative nevertheless remains and is significant. I will not further develop my view of truth and falsehood, but will proceed to the examination of Dewey's doctrine. Dewey does not aim at judgments that shall be absolutely true, or condemn their contradictories as absolutely false. In his opinion, there is a process called inquiry, which is one form of mutual adjustment between an organism and its environment. If I wished, from my point of view, to go as far as possible towards agreeing with Dewey, I should begin by an analysis of meaning or significance. Suppose, for example, you are at the zoo, and you hear a voice through a megaphone saying, "A lion has just escaped." You will, in that case, act as you would if you saw the lion. That is to say, you will get away as quickly as possible. The sentence, "A lion has escaped," means a certain occurrence. in the sense that it promotes the same behavior as the occurrence would if you saw it. Broadly, a sentence S means an event E if it promotes behavior which E would have promoted. If there has in fact been no such occurrence, the sentence is false. Just the same applies to a belief which is not expressed in words. One may say, a belief is a state of an organism promoting behavior such as certain occurrence would promote if sensibly present. The occurrence which would promote this behavior is the significance of the belief. This statement is unduly simplified, but it may serve to indicate the theory I am advocating. So far, I do not think that Dewey and I would disagree very much, but with his further developments, I find myself in very definite disagreement. Dewey makes inquiry the essence of logic, not truth or knowledge. He defines inquiry as follows. Inquiry is the controlled or directed transformation of an indeterminate situation into one that is so determinate in its constituent distinctions and relations as to convert the elements of the original situation into a unified whole. He adds that inquiry is concerned with objective transformations of objective subject matter. This definition is plainly inadequate. Take, for instance, the dealings of a drill sergeant with a crowd of recruits, or of a bricklayer with a heap of bricks. These exactly fulfill Dewey's definition of inquiry. Since he clearly would not include them, there must be an element in his notion of inquiry which he has forgotten to mention in his definition. What this element is, I shall attempt to determine in a moment, but let us first consider what emerges from the definition as it stands. It is clear that inquiry, as conceived by Dewey, is part of the general process of attempting to make the world more organic. Unified wholes are to be the outcome of inquiries. Dewey's love of what is organic is due partly to biology, partly to the lingering influence of Hegel. Unless on the basis of an unconscious Hegelian metaphysic, I do not see why inquiry should be expected to result in unified wholes. If I am given a pack of cards in disorder and asked to inquire into their sequence, I shall, if I follow Dewey's prescription, first arrange them in order, and then say that this was the order resulting from inquiry. There will be, it is true, an objective transformation of objective subject matter while I am arranging the cards, but the definition allows for this. If at the end I am told, we wanted to know the sequence of the cards when they were given to you, not after you had rearranged them, I shall, if I am a disciple of Dewey, reply, your ideas are altogether too static. I am a dynamic person, and when I inquire into any subject matter, I first alter it in such a way as to make the inquiry easy. The notion that such a procedure is legitimate can only be justified by a Hegelian distinction of appearance and reality. The appearance may be confused and fragmentary, but the reality is always orderly and organic. Therefore, when I arrange the cards, I am only revealing their true eternal nature. But this part of the doctrine is never made explicit. The metaphysic of organism underlies Dewey's theories, but I do not know how far he is aware of this fact. Let us now try to find the supplement to Dewey's definition which is required in order to distinguish inquiry from other kinds of organizing activity, such as those of the drill sergeant and the bricklayer. Formally, it would have been said that inquiry is distinguished by its purpose, which is to ascertain some truth. But for Dewey, truth is to be defined in terms of inquiry, not vice versa. He quotes with approval Pierce's definition. Truth is the opinion which is fated to be ultimately agreed to by all who investigate. This leaves us completely in the dark as to what the investigators are doing, for we cannot, without circularity, say that they are endeavouring to ascertain the truth. I think Dr. Dewey's theory might be stated as follows. The relations of an organism to its environment are sometimes satisfactory to the organism, sometimes unsatisfactory. When they are unsatisfactory, the situation may be improved by mutual adjustment. When the alterations by means of which the situation is improved are mainly on the side of the organism, they are never wholly on either side, the process involved is called inquiry. For example, during a battle you are mainly concerned to alter the environment, that is, the enemy. But during the preceding period of reconnaissance, you are mainly concerned to adapt your own forces to his dispositions. This earlier period is one of inquiry. The difficulty of this theory, to my mind, lies in the severing of the relation between a belief and the fact or facts which would commonly be said to verify it. Let us continue to consider the example of a general planning a battle. His reconnaissance planes report to him certain enemy preparations, and he, in consequence, makes certain counter-preparations. Common sense would say that the reports upon which he acts are true if, in fact, the enemy have made the moves which they are said to have made, and that in that case the reports remain true even if the general subsequently loses the battle. This view is rejected by Dr. Dewey. He does not divide beliefs into true and false, but he still has two kinds of beliefs, which we will call satisfactory if the general wins, and unsatisfactory if he is defeated. Until the battle has taken place, he cannot tell what to think about the reports of his scouts. Generalizing, we may say that Dr. Dewey, like everyone else, divides beliefs into two classes, of which one is good and the other bad. He holds, however, that a belief may be good at one time and bad at another. This happens with imperfect theories which are better than their predecessors but worse than their successors. Whether a belief is good or bad depends upon whether the activities which it inspires in the organism entertaining the belief have consequences which are satisfactory or unsatisfactory to it. Thus, a belief about some event in the past is to be classified as good or bad, not according to whether the event really took place, but according to the future effects of the belief. The results are curious. Suppose somebody says to me, "Did you have coffee with your breakfast this morning?" If I am an ordinary person, I shall try to remember. But if I am a disciple of Dr. Dewey, I shall say, "Wait a while. I must try two experiments before I can tell you." I shall then first make myself believe that I had coffee and observe the consequences, if any. I shall then make myself believe that I did not have coffee and again observe the consequences, if any. I shall then compare the two sets of consequences to see which I found the more satisfactory. If there is a balance on one side, I shall decide for that answer. If there is not, I shall have to confess that I cannot answer the question. But this is not the end of our troubles. How am I to know the consequences of believing that I had coffee for breakfast if I say the consequences are such and such? This, in turn, will have to be tested by its consequences before I can know whether what I have said was a good or a bad statement. And even if this difficulty were overcome, how am I to judge which set of consequences is the more satisfactory? One decision as to whether I had coffee may fill me with contentment, the other with determination to further the war effort. Each of these may be considered good, but until I have decided which is better, I cannot tell whether I had coffee for breakfast. Surely this is absurd. Dewey's divergence from what has hitherto been regarded as common sense is due to his refusal to admit facts into his metaphysic, in the sense in which facts are stubborn and cannot be manipulated. In this it may be that common sense is changing, and that his view will not seem contrary to what common sense is becoming. The main difference between Dr. Dewey and me is that he judges a belief by its effects, whereas I judge it by its causes, where a past occurrence is concerned. I consider such a belief true, or as nearly true as we can make it, if it has a certain kind of relation, sometimes very complicated, to its causes. Dr. Dewey holds that it has warranted assertability, which he substitutes for truth, if it has certain kinds of effects. This divergence is connected with a difference of outlook on the world. The past cannot be affected by what we do, and therefore, if truth is determined by what has happened, it is independent of present or future volitions. It represents, in logical form, the limitations on human power. But if truth, or rather warranted assertability, depends upon the future, then insofar as it is in our power to alter the future, it is in our power to alter what should be asserted. This enlarges the sense of human power and freedom. Did Caesar cross the Rubicon? I should regard an affirmative answer as unalterably necessitated by a past event. Dr. Dewey would decide whether to say yes or no by an appraisal of future events, and there is no reason why these future events could not be arranged by human power so as to make a negative answer the more satisfactory. If I find the belief that Caesar crossed the Rubicon very distasteful, I need not sit down in dull despair. I can, if I have enough skill and power, arrange a social environment in which the statement that he did not cross the Rubicon will have warranted assertability. Throughout this book, I have sought, where possible, to connect philosophies with the social environment of the philosophers concerned. It has seemed to me that the belief in human power and the unwillingness to admit stubborn facts were connected with the hopefulness engendered by machine production and the scientific manipulation of our physical environment. This view is shared by many of Dr. Dewey's supporters. Thus, George Raymond Geiger, in a laudatory essay, says that Dr. Dewey's method would mean a revolution in thought just as middle class and unspectacular, but just as stupendous as the revolution in industry of a century ago. It seemed to me that I was saying the same thing when I wrote, Dr. Dewey has an outlook which, where it is distinctive, is in harmony with the age of industrialism and collective enterprise. It is natural that his strongest appeal should be to Americans, and also that he should be almost equally appreciated by the progressive elements in countries like China and Mexico. To my regret and surprise, this statement, which I had supposed completely innocuous, vexed Dr. Dewey, who replied, Mr. Russell's confirmed habit of connecting the pragmatic theory of knowing with obnoxious aspects of American industrialism is much as if I were to link his philosophy to the interests of the English landed aristocracy. For my part, I am accustomed to having my opinions explained, especially by communists, as due to my connection with the British aristocracy, and I am quite willing to suppose that my views, like other men's, are influenced by social environment. But if in regard to Dr. Dewey I am mistaken as to the social influences concerned, I regret the mistake. I find, however, that I am not alone in having made it. Santayana, for instance, says, in Dewey, as in current science and ethics, there is a pervasive quasi-Hegelian tendency to dissolve the individual into his social functions as well as everything substantial and actual into something relative and transitional. Dr. Dewey's world, it seems to me, is one in which human beings occupy the imagination. The cosmos of astronomy, though of course acknowledged to exist, is at most times ignored. His philosophy is a power philosophy, though not, like Nietzsche's, a philosophy of individual power. It is the power of the community that is felt to be valuable. It is this element of social power that seems to me to make the philosophy of instrumentalism attractive to those who are more impressed by our new control over natural forces than by the limitations to which that control is still subject. The attitude of man towards the non-human environment has differed profoundly at different times. The Greeks, with their dread of hubris and their belief in a necessity or fate superior even to Zeus, carefully avoided what would have seemed to them insolence towards the universe. The Middle Ages carried submission much further. Humility towards God was a Christian's first duty. Initiative was cramped by this attitude, and great originality was scarcely possible. The Renaissance restored human pride, but carried it to the point where it led to anarchy and disaster. Its work was largely undone by the Reformation and the Counter-Reformation. But modern technique, while not altogether favorable to the lordly individual of the Renaissance, has revived the sense of the collective power of human communities. Man, formerly too humble, begins to think of himself as almost a god. The Italian pragmatist Papini urges us to substitute the imitation of God for the imitation of Christ. In all this I feel a grave danger, the danger of what might be called cosmic impiety. The concept of truth as something dependent upon facts largely outside human control has been one of the ways in which philosophy hitherto has inculcated the necessary element of humility. When this check upon pride is removed, a further step is taken on the road towards a certain kind of madness. The intoxication of power which invaded philosophy with Fichte and to which modern men, whether philosophers or not, are prone. I am persuaded that this intoxication is the greatest danger of our time, and that any philosophy, which, however unintentionally, contributes to it, is increasing the danger of vast social disaster. Chapter 31. The Philosophy of Logical Analysis. In philosophy, ever since the time of Pythagoras, there has been an opposition between the men whose thought was mainly inspired by mathematics and those who were more influenced by the empirical sciences. Plato, Thomas Aquinas, Spinoza, and Kant belong to what may be called the mathematical party. Democritus, Aristotle, and the modern empiricists from Locke onwards belong to the opposite party. In our day, a school of philosophy has arisen which sets to work to eliminate Pythagoreanism from the principles of mathematics and to combine empiricism with an interest in the deductive parts of human knowledge. The aims of this school are less spectacular than those of most philosophers in the past, but some of its achievements are as solid as those of the men of science. The origin of this philosophy is in the achievements of mathematicians who set to work to purge their subject of fallacies and slipshod reasoning. The great mathematicians of the 17th century were optimistic and anxious for quick results. Consequently, they left the foundations of analytical geometry and the infinitesimal calculus insecure. Leibniz believed in actual infinitesimals. But although this belief suited his metaphysics, it had no sound basis in mathematics. Weierstrass, soon after the middle of the 19th century, showed how to establish the calculus without infinitesimals, and thus at last made it logically secure. Next came Georg Cantor, who developed the theory of continuity and infinite number. Continuity had been, until he defined it, a vague word, convenient for philosophers like Hegel, who wished to introduce metaphysical muddles into mathematics. Cantor gave a precise significance to the word, and showed that continuity, as he defined it, was the concept needed by mathematicians and physicists. By this means, a great deal of mysticism, such as that of Bergson, was rendered antiquated. Cantor also overcame the long-standing logical puzzles about infinite number. Take the series of whole numbers from 1 onwards. How many of them are there? Clearly, the number is not finite. Up to 1,000, there are 1,000 numbers, up to 1,000,000, 1,000,000. Whatever finite number you mention, there are evidently more numbers than that, because from 1 up to the number in question, there are just that number of numbers, and then there are others that are greater. The number of finite whole numbers must, therefore, be an infinite number. But now comes a curious fact. The number of even numbers must be the same as the number of all whole numbers. Consider the two rows. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and so on. 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, and so on. There is one entry in the lower row for every one in the top row. Therefore, the number of terms in the two rows must be the same, although the lower row consists of only half the terms in the top row. Leibniz, who noticed this, thought it a contradiction and concluded that, though there are infinite collections, there are no infinite numbers. Georg Cantor, on the contrary, boldly denied that this is a contradiction. He was right. It is only an oddity. Georg Cantor defined an infinite collection as one which has parts containing as many terms as the whole collection contains. On this basis, he was able to build up a most interesting mathematical theory of infinite numbers, thereby taking into the realm of exact logic a whole region formerly given over to mysticism and confusion. The next man of importance was Frege, who published his first work in 1879 and his definition of number in 1884. But in spite of the epoch-making nature of his discoveries, he remained wholly without recognition until I drew attention to him in 1903. It is remarkable that before Frege, every definition of number that had been suggested contained elementary logical blunders. It was customary to identify number with plurality. But an instance of number is a particular number, say 3, and an instance of 3 is a particular triad. The triad is a plurality, but the class of all triads, which Frege identified with the number 3, is a plurality of pluralities. And number in general, of which 3 is an instance, is a plurality of pluralities of pluralities. The elementary grammatical mistake of confounding this with the simple plurality of a given triad made the whole philosophy of number, before Frege, a tissue of nonsense, in the strictest sense of the term, nonsense. From Frege's work it followed that arithmetic, and pure mathematics generally, is nothing but a prolongation of deductive logic. This disproved Kant's theory that arithmetical propositions are synthetic and involve a reference to time. The development of pure mathematics from logic was set forth in detail in Principia Mathematica by Whitehead and myself. It gradually became clear that a great part of philosophy can be reduced to something that may be called syntax, though the word has to be used in a somewhat wider sense than has hitherto been customary. Some men, notably Carnap, have advanced the theory that all philosophical problems are really syntactical, and that when errors in syntax are avoided, a philosophical problem is thereby either solved or shown to be insoluble. I think this is an overstatement, but there can be no doubt that the utility of philosophical syntax in relation to traditional problems is very great. I will illustrate its utility by a brief explanation of what is called the theory of descriptions. By a description, I mean a phrase such as the present President of the United States, in which a person or thing is designated, not by name, but by some property which is supposed or known to be peculiar to him or it. Such phrases had given a lot of trouble. Suppose I say, the Golden Mountain does not exist, and suppose you ask, what is it that does not exist? It would seem that if I say, it is the Golden Mountain, I am attributing some sort of existence to it. Obviously, I am not making the same statement as if I said, the round square does not exist. This seemed to imply that the Golden Mountain is one thing and the round square is another, although neither exists. The theory of descriptions was designed to meet this and other difficulties. According to this theory, when a statement containing a phrase of the form, the so-and-so is rightly analyzed, the phrase, the so-and-so, disappears. For example, take the statement, Scott was the author of Waverley. The theory interprets this statement as saying, one and only one man wrote Waverley, and that man was Scott. Or more fully, there is an entity C such that the statement X wrote Waverley is true if X is C and false otherwise. Moreover, C is Scott. The first part of this, before the word moreover, is defined as meaning the author of Waverley exists, or existed, or will exist. Thus, the Golden Mountain does not exist means there is no entity C such that X is golden and mountainous is true when X is C but not otherwise. With this definition, the puzzle as to what is meant when we say the Golden Mountain does not exist disappears. Existence, according to this theory, can only be asserted of descriptions. We can say the author of Waverley exists, but to say Scott exists is bad grammar, or rather, bad syntax. This clears up 2 millennia of muddle-headedness about existence, beginning with Plato's Theaetetus. One result of the work we have been considering is to dethrone mathematics from the lofty place that it has occupied since Pythagoras and Plato, and to destroy the presumption against empiricism which has been derived from it. Mathematical knowledge, it is true, is not obtained by induction from experience. Our reason for believing that 2 and 2 are 4 is not that we have so often found, by observation, that one couple and another couple together make a quartet. In this sense, mathematical knowledge is still not empirical. But it is also not a priori knowledge about the world. It is, in fact, merely verbal knowledge. 3 means 2 plus 1. And 4 means 3 plus 1. Hence it follows, that the proof is long, that 4 means the same as 2 plus 2. Thus, mathematical knowledge ceases to be mysterious. It is all of the same nature as the great truth, that there are 3 feet in a yard. Physics, as well as pure mathematics, has supplied material for the philosophy of logical analysis. This has occurred especially through the theory of relativity and quantum mechanics. What is important to the philosopher in the theory of relativity is the substitution of space-time for space and time. Common sense thinks of the physical world as composed of things, which persist through a certain period of time and move in space. Philosophy and physics developed the notion of thing into that of material substance, and thought of material substance as consisting of particles, each very small, and each persisting throughout all time. Einstein substituted events for particles. Each event had to each other a relation called interval, which could be analyzed in various ways into a time element and a space element. The choice between these various ways was arbitrary, and no one of them was theoretically preferable to any other. Given 2 events, A and B, in different regions, it might happen that according to one convention they were simultaneous, according to another A was earlier than B, and according to yet another, B was earlier than A. No physical facts correspond to these different conventions. From all this, it seems to follow that events, not particles, must be the stuff of physics. What has been thought of as a particle will have to be thought of as a series of events. The series of events that replaces a particle has certain important physical properties and therefore demands our attention, but it has no more substantiality than any other series of events that we might arbitrarily single out. Thus, matter is not part of the ultimate material of the world, but merely a convenient way of collecting events into bundles. Quantum theory reinforces this conclusion, but its chief philosophical importance is that it regards physical phenomena as possibly discontinuous. It suggests that, in an atom, interpreted as above, a certain state of affairs persists for a certain time and then suddenly is replaced by a finitely different state of affairs. Continuity of motion, which had always been assumed, appears to have been a mere prejudice. The philosophy appropriate to quantum theory, however, has not yet been adequately developed. I suspect that it will demand even more radical departures from the traditional doctrine of space and time than those demanded by the theory of relativity. While physics has been making matter less material, psychology has been making mind less mental. We had occasion in a former chapter to compare the association of ideas with the conditioned reflex. The latter, which has replaced the former, is obviously much more physiological. This is only one illustration. I do not wish to exaggerate the scope of the conditioned reflex. Thus, from both ends, physics and psychology have been approaching each other and making more possible the doctrine of neutral monism suggested by William James's criticism of consciousness. The distinction of mind and matter came into philosophy from religion, although for a long time it seemed to have valid grounds. I think that both mind and matter are merely convenient ways of grouping events. Some single events, I should admit, belong only to material groups, but others belong to both kinds of groups, and are therefore at once mental and material. This doctrine effects a great simplification in our picture of the structure of the world. Modern physics and physiology throw a new light upon the ancient problem of perception. If there is to be anything that can be called perception, it must be, in some degree, an effect of the object perceived, and it must more or less resemble the object if it is to be a source of knowledge of the object. The first requisite can only be fulfilled if there are causal chains which are, to a greater or less extent, independent of the rest of the world. According to physics, this is the case. Light waves travel from the sun to the earth, and in doing so obey their own laws. This is only roughly true. Einstein has shown that light rays are affected by gravitation. When they reach our atmosphere, they suffer refraction, and some are more scattered than others. When they reach a human eye, all sorts of things happen which would not happen elsewhere, ending up with what we call seeing the sun. But although the sun of our visual experience is very different from the sun of the astronomer, it is still a source of knowledge as to the latter, because seeing the sun differs from seeing the moon in ways that are causally connected with the difference between the astronomer's sun and the astronomer's moon. What we can know of physical objects in this way, however, is only certain abstract properties of structure. We can know that the sun is round in a sense, though not quite the sense in which what we see is round. But we have no reason to suppose that it is bright or warm, because physics can account for its seeming so without supposing that it is so. Our knowledge of the physical world, therefore, is only abstract and mathematical. Modern analytical empiricism, of which I have been giving an outline, differs from that of Locke, Berkeley, and Hume by its incorporation of mathematics and its development of a powerful logical technique. It is thus able, in regard to certain problems, to achieve definite answers, which have the quality of science rather than of philosophy. It has the advantage, as compared with the philosophies of the system builders, of being able to tackle its problems one at a time, instead of having to invent, at one stroke, a block theory of the whole universe. Its methods in this respect resemble those of science. I have no doubt that, in so far as philosophical knowledge is possible, it is by such methods that it must be sought. I have also no doubt that by these methods many ancient problems are completely soluble. There remains, however, a vast field, traditionally included in philosophy, where scientific methods are inadequate. This field includes ultimate questions of value. Science alone, for example, cannot prove that it is bad to enjoy the infliction of cruelty. Whatever can be known by means of science, but things which are legitimately matters of feeling lie outside its province. Philosophy, throughout its history, has consisted of two parts inharmoniously blended. On the one hand, a theory as to the nature of the world, on the other, an ethical or political doctrine as to the best way of living. The failure to separate these two with sufficient clarity has been a source of much confused thinking. Philosophers from Plato to William James have allowed their opinions as to the constitution of the universe to be influenced by the desire for edification. Knowing, as they supposed, what beliefs would make men virtuous, they have invented arguments, often very sophistical, to prove that these beliefs are true. For my part, I reprobate this kind of bias, both on moral and on intellectual grounds. Morally, a philosopher who uses his professional competence for anything except a disinterested search for truth is guilty of a kind of treachery. And when he assumes, in advance of inquiry, that certain beliefs, whether true or false, are such as to promote good behavior, he is so limiting the scope of philosophical speculation as to make philosophy trivial. The true philosopher is prepared to examine all preconceptions. When any limits...
A little more alert. Do you know it?
...of truth, philosophy becomes paralyzed by fear, and the ground is prepared for a government censorship punishing those who utter dangerous thoughts. In fact, the philosopher has already placed such a censorship over his own investigations. Intellectually, the effect of mistaken moral considerations upon philosophy has been to impede progress to an extraordinary extent. I do not myself believe that philosophy can either prove or disprove the truth of religious dogmas, but ever since Plato, most philosophers have considered it part of their business to produce proofs of immortality and the existence of God. They have found fault with the proofs of their predecessors. St. Thomas rejected St. Anselm's proofs, and Kant rejected Descartes. But they have supplied new ones of their own. In order to make their proofs seem valid, they have had to falsify logic, to make mathematics mystical, and to pretend that deep-seated prejudices were heaven-sent intuitions. All this is rejected by the philosophers who make logical analysis the main business of philosophy. They confess frankly that the human intellect is unable to find conclusive answers to many questions of profound importance to mankind. But they refuse to believe that there is some higher way of knowing by which we can discover truths hidden from science and the intellect. For this renunciation, they have been rewarded by the discovery that many questions, formerly obscured by the fog of metaphysics, can be answered with precision, and by objective methods which introduce nothing of the philosopher's temperament except the desire to understand. Take such questions as, what is number, what are space and time, what is mind, and what is matter? I do not say that we can here and now give definitive answers to all these ancient questions, but I do say that a method has been discovered by which, as in science, we can make successive approximations to the truth, in which each new stage results from an improvement, not a rejection of what has gone before. In the welter of conflicting fanaticisms, one of the few unifying forces is scientific truthfulness, by which I mean the habit of basing our beliefs upon observations and inferences as impersonal and as much divested of local and temperamental bias as is possible for human beings. To have insisted upon the introduction of this virtue into philosophy and to have invented a powerful method by which it can be rendered fruitful are the chief merits of the philosophical school of which I am a member. The habit of careful veracity acquired in the practice of this philosophical method can be extended to the whole sphere of human activity, producing, wherever it exists, a lessening of fanaticism with an increasing capacity of sympathy and mutual understanding. In abandoning a part of its dogmatic pretensions, philosophy does not cease to suggest and inspire a way of life.